So Mike is going to talk right here.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
Welcome to the July meeting of the Women in the Academy Commission. I'm State Representative Rebecca Chavez-Cow. I am co-chair along with my colleagues, the Representative Becky Edwards. And we are going to do a bit of an adjustment to the agenda this morning. We were going to do breakout meetings with the committee, subcommittees initially, but we have our speaker here. We want to be able to respect her time. So we're just going to exit that so we can have her go first. Before we do that, I'm going to ask everyone to, I'm just going to have you introduce yourself, but I'm going to give you a couple of minutes to read the minutes if you have not already done so, and entertain a motion to adopt the minutes from the June meeting when someone feels so compelled to do so. There's a motion that has been made to approve the minutes. Can I hear a second? Oh, we've got a second from Commissioner Burkholder. All those in favor of adopting the minutes from June the 2nd, please signify yay.
Yay.
All righty. These are have been adopted. Thank you. So we are going to invite Danny Nader. Is that how we pronounce your last name?
Nader.
Sorry.
No, we pronounce it
as Nader. From Kearns High School, please join us here at the table. We'll get your mic set up, and I'm going to ask Representative Edwards to give us a bit of background of why we have invited Danny here. And then we'll do a brief introduction to the, you know, who all is here at the table, and then have you come with us this morning.
Okay.
So I really appreciate the opportunity to hear again from Danny Nader, who is a counselor at Kearns High School. I first heard her speak as a part of a presentation at State Workforce Investment Board, and I think it was in maybe April of this year, and I'm on one of the subcommittees, and she presents in our subcommittee about her work as a high school counselor and her influence she's had in some of the initiatives there to increase college attendance, well, college applications, college attendance in what is an incredibly diverse population, and for many of her students, this is their first, many of them would be first generation college students, and I felt like there was a real link between some of the discussions we're having, the populations we're trying to address. And if you remember last month, we had Melissa Miller-Kinhart, who was formerly the Assistant Commissioner for Outreach and Access with UGE. She presented, and really, if you think about these two presentations, they are complementing each other. So that was sort of like the 30,000 foot view, and now Ms. Nader is going to tell us what things are really like, boots on the ground, take us all back to however many years it's been for each of us, back to the high school years, and fill us in on how things are working and where the gaps still are, what we can do better. And Danny, do you want to have questions as you're going, or do you want to have, like, the end?
We, as we're going.
Okay.
Definitely.
Yeah. Great. So I'll be manning the little buttons up here, and Mr. Chavez-Cow will call on, let you know if there are questions. So anyway, we really appreciate the opportunity to hear from you, and especially when it's your, quote, summer vacation here as a teacher. So anyway, thank you for being with us, and time's yours.
Well, I wanted to go ahead and
introduce herself, yes.
So that she knows, because she is speaking, and kind of the background of the commissioners, who they are, why they've been selected to serve on this commission. So let's start with Commissioner Wallace.
My name is Emery Wallace. I'm the Program Director of the Women's Business Center at the Salt Lake Chamber, and I represent small business on occasion.
Hi there, I'm Trina Irene, and I'm an Executive Vice President and Director of Recruiting at Dallas Bank Corporation, and I represent large businesses on the commission.
Hi, I'm Sherry Main, and I represent the Department of Workforce Services. I'm the Chief Economist and the Director of Workforce Research and Analysis there at the department.
Becky Edwards, I'm State Representative from Davis County.
And Rebecca Chavez-Halk, I'm a representative from downtown area Salt Lake City.
I'm Jenny Robinson with the University of Utah.
Jennifer Schneeling, former representative and sponsor of the original enabling legislation creating this person.
I'm Ann Burkholder, the Chief Executive Officer for my deputy.
Senator Deborah Henderson
representing
the Senate.
All right. Okay, so am I good on my mic? Do we need? I have a really loud voice, so
yes.
I probably don't actually need it. So I have to push
here.
Okay. Yeah, I have a super loud voice, so sorry about that. Microphone's always making me a little bit nervous. So, no, I am honored to be here to speak to you guys today. I may or may not have been a true teacher and done a little bit of research before I came today. And I'm just really excited to get to speak to such an amazing group of women. And you guys have all done a lot of great things. And I hope that I can share with you some of the things that I'm doing, that, you know, my school district is doing, that counseling in the state is doing. And then, like Representative Edwards, that just any questions, please let me know. I would prefer that we have more of a discussion-based conversation than me just telling you a bunch of information, because I don't always think that's super helpful, because I would rather tell you things you want to hear and that are going to be beneficial for you, and just be able to share what I want. So to start off with just a little background information about myself, I have lived in Utah my entire life. I grew up in West Valley City. I graduated from Hunter High School, and I was a first-generation college student. I attended Southern Utah University for my undergraduate and received a degree in sociology and health education with a secondary education certificate. So I had a really great degree, you know. Sociology is super beneficial in the high school. No, it's not. I worked in one of the biggest high schools in the state, and we taught one sociology, period. And so I didn't have a super marketable degree, surprise. And so I did not get a teaching job right out of college. So I went to actually work at the Department of Workforce Services. I was an employment counselor at the Department of Workforce Services for 2 years before I got a teaching job. I actually went back to Hunter High School. I was a health teacher, and then I also coached. I was a head coach for cheerleading, for drill teams. Did a lot of work with the girls there, and served on several committees, did all of that. And then I decided that I would like to go back to school, get my master's. I got my master's from Utah State in school counseling. And I finished that and became a counselor at Kearns High School. I made the switch over to counseling last year. So that was my first year of counseling. When I taught health, and then I also taught a class that's called School Success in our school, but it's pretty much kind of like a specialized group. Instead of being a counselor and having 400 students, it was like I had 30 students and did work closely with their counselors. For kids that just needed extra support, we worked in a pretty high at-risk population in general, but our really at-risk students were placed into that class. So obviously that's something I'm passionate about right now at Kearns High School. For those of you that don't know our demographic, right now we are at about 50% minority. It wavers back and forth. Sometimes we're 51%, 52%. But we right around that 50% mark. We also fall right about the 50% mark on our grade reduced lunch. So our socioeconomic is pretty low also.
And so we're working with that underserved population. We're working with the minority students. The majority of our students are first-generation college students. And that's why I am where I am. That is what I am passionate about. That is the work that I would like to do and like to continue to do with our underserved population. That's why I moved on to the counseling career, because I felt like I could do more work there than I could as a teacher. I loved teaching. It was great. But I felt like more of what I was passionate about and what I was doing was more towards the counseling aspect. So that's where I'm at right now. People always want to talk numbers. One of our things that we work with right now, we follow the same thing with our numbers. I have about, depending on our enrollment, we have a very transient enrollment in our area, but I run about 380 to 400 to 1. So I have about 380 to 400 any given time during the year students that I am in charge of. And that's the thing. We have 6 counselors at our school, and we all have about that caseload. So it's a lot. It's difficult. That is one of our barriers. That is a huge barrier, is trying to get that individual meeting with 180 days of school to meet with each kid individually and sit down and talk about their plan for the future and then continue on with that plan. We see great barriers with that because of those numbers. And that's one of our things that we're really trying to work with and see where we can be, what we can do, programs that we can run that will have a big impact on a large group. And so that's kind of some of the things that we've gone through, and that's where we've run into things like the college application week, our step-up programs, and different things like that. Some of the things that I spoke about with the Workforce Investment Committee that we talked about that seemed to have a lot of questions and brought a lot of dialogue up was this college piece. And obviously with the governor's initiative and with that, we're all working towards trying to prepare our students to become college and career ready. But I think that one of the pieces that we're seeing is that there is a gap there with the career part of it, is that we have this college piece. And Melissa Miller-Tankhart came and spoke with you, and I've worked a lot with her with the College Application Week. So French High School is a pilot school for the College Application Week, which was awesome. We were invited to participate because we did have our demographic. That was pretty much solely why we were chosen, is we were willing, and we had a demographic of an underserved population that they were looking for. We have a lower graduation rate. Our graduation rate is currently, we have increased by 5% this last year, which was amazing. So we were at 74% for the 2014 school year. We don't have numbers for 2015 yet. So we were at 74% graduation rate. And so we kind of fit that demographic of what they're looking at and how can we get to these populations. So we piloted the College Application Week, and they kind of said, run with it. We worked a little bit with Melissa. They gave us an outline of this is how it's done nationally. Kind of do what you want. Well, we were really excited. I was an intern at the time, so I kind of got a lot of the work of that, because obviously they still have students to meet with and I didn't. And so I was able to really run with the College Application Week and really work with it. And that first year that we did it, we were able to get 82% of our seniors to apply for college. And by apply, we mean that they sat down, completed the application through the payment process. So it was paid, it was submitted, and it was given, which was awesome. We were so excited about that. So then, because of the work we had done and the way we had set things up, we were able to become the model school for the state of Utah. There were 8 schools in the pilot, and in the 2014-15 school year, I think they had 37 schools participate throughout the state of Utah in College Application Week. So we were able to do a lot of work, show people how we did it, our model, that worked for us, so that they could then adapt it to their school and to their demographic and their population. We also tweaked ours. A pilot, as you know, is always a little chaotic and crazy, so we learned things we did wrong. We were able to tweak, and in this 14-15 school year, we had 90% of our seniors that were able to apply through the payment process. A big part of that is payment. Everybody's like, well, how did you pay? We have an amazing foundation. Our Granite Education Foundation, through our school district, donated $500 to each school. And then I called after the first 2 days and was like, we're out of money. I've met my $500 and I have, 12 days of this left. I've only got, 8 of my classes seniors. And so I called, and our district is amazing, and said, you know what? There are plenty of schools that do not need the money as much as you do, because if you know grad school districts, we have our half here, and then we have Skyline and Olympus, and we have that little bench there. But obviously it's not as much in need as under current Cypress Ranger area. And so they said whatever anybody else doesn't use, we'll give to you. And so she said, send it, we'll figure it out. And I also approached the United Way. We partner with the United Way in our school. They're housed in our school, but they do their community outreach through our elementary schools, our feeder junior highs, and through Kearns High School. So they reach the whole Kearns area. I asked our representative for that, whose name is Steve Walcott, and within, like, it was probably 2 days, he had $500 more for me. So he gave me $500 more, and then I received $400 from the other schools. We had $1,400 that we were able to donate, and students were able to pay for college applications. So we were really excited. It was great. We had 90% of our students. The state was impressed. The district was impressed. We were feeling pretty good about it. And then we kind of had a reality check moment, is that our other numbers came in. And so we're like, yeah, 90%, we're doing great, we're making this huge difference. And then we get the numbers of our students that actually attend college. And at Kearns High School, we're right around the 30% mark. Sometimes it's a little lower, sometimes it's a little higher. But give or take, about 30% of our students enroll in college in the fall semesters. So we look at that and say, okay, then as me, it took a little bit of a swallow my pride and quit patting myself on the back for my 90% to realize 70% of my students are not being reached. 70% of my students, what good did it do them to fill out that college application? Yes, it is a good thing. I fully am still on the soapbox of College Application Week. I think it is an amazing initiative, but I think that there's a gap there. There's a problem because those kids applied, and that may help them in 3 years. They've had the confidence builder. And it's great to see our kids. I mean, they're like, really? Me? Why am I applying for college? I can't go to college. Yeah, man, college is great. Anybody, you know, we're doing this, we're pushing them. And it was amazing, but it's not resonating. And that's kind of, as I spoke in April, and since April, it's exploded even bigger. Kind of my soapbox I'm standing on right now, and that I'm trying so hard to be a voice, is that, you know, we have got to change now our perception. Because we're looking at college, and we're saying kids need to be college and career ready. But when we say college and career ready, our kids, us, parents, everybody, we think they need to go to university to find an engineering degree. You know, and that's how kids see it. And then they're intimidated, and they're like, well, I can't do that. And I've been trying to figure out, well, how can we do this? Because we're not reaching kids. We're not seeing what we need to see or doing what we need to do. We're not showing them what college is. Yeah.
Okay, perfect. Oh, Danny, this is great information. Thank you for sharing it. One thing, as a mother of a daughter who's going to be a senior this coming fall, I know that the FAFSA form is really complicated. I'm actually apprehensive myself about having to fill that out. Is that included in the college application week, that the FAFSA form is completed at the same time?
It's another initiative. So what it is we do in our school, we did incorporate the FAFSA PIN. So because they do college application week in November, so they can't do the full FAFSA.
Right.
But we do their FAFSA PIN, and then, like at our school, we were called the folder school because we gave our kids a folder. Because technology, that is not always there, but we gave them these big yellow folders, and we put a big sticker inside where they could put their FAFSA PIN, and they could put all that, and then we taped a big flyer for our FAFSA completion night. So then the state runs, our school has, again, because we are an underserved population, we have a college access advisor. So we have a grant that we have an actual college access advisor from the University of Utah. It's a recent university graduate who comes in, and that's their job, is college outreach. So they run a FAFSA completion night, and then one by themselves and one they partner with USHE. And then they come in, and that is open to anybody, parents, and students are encouraged to come in. They've already got the PIN, and then they'll go through the end. They tell them, bring their tax information. They'll walk them through it. But again, the UFAM committee that I sat on, that's another thing that we're working on there, is that we're reaching our populations that understand it. But it is intimidating. You're right. It's, for people that have done it, we're college-educated individuals. We've gone to college, and it's scary and confusing. Mm-hmm. So for people that never even graduated high school, that would actually get the money. That's why I think right now we said there's $54 million in the state of Utah that went unclaimed in FAFSA money.
I'm wondering what the percentage, if you have this number, because 90% is a really, it's a great stat to have, but I'm wondering what the conversion percentage is from those that received, that completed the application that then did the FAFSA, because that's going to be huge in their ability to actually pay to go to college.
Sad number. I have that number. It's a sad one. And that's the piece that I would like. Okay, we've got all this going on, but we're not putting it together. We've had like 25% of our kids fully complete the FAFSA.
Okay.
And our demographic is the kids that are not getting that $54 million. Those are the ones that are going to get it. Our kids up on our bench schools are, they don't qualify for Pell Grants. Their parents are making too much money, but our kids that are underserved, their parents don't know how to do it. And so we have the local college access network in Grant School District. We have members from the United Way, from UC, from UHEA, from all of that. That's what we're working on, is how can we better reach these students? How can we get these parents? Because we have these outreach nights, but not a lot of them are coming, or they're intimidated by it, or they don't have their taxes. Well, can we have someone completing taxes there so they can get their taxes done and then go right into the FAFSA? Or can we reach out to, most of them are getting their taxes done at, the Walmart setup that's right there. So can we go into that tax center and say, hey, will you speak to them about FAFSA? Will you say, hey, presented by your income, you should go talk to your student counselor or your student school about this? And so we are working on that because, that's a huge barrier.
I'm wondering if that's something that the committee could put on our agenda to look at, maybe ways to have agencies or individuals volunteer. Because I can't imagine it's unique to Kern.
No, it's not. It's everywhere. It's especially Grant School District. And again, with this whole thing, I need to ask Rick that I can speak for my district. I can speak for my school. Every district is different. Every school is different. But I have worked a lot. I serve on, the UAC committee, so the state CEE committee. I have met with other districts and other counselors and all of this. A lot of it is demographic. That's why I'm the one here speaking to you, because it's the population that needs to. If we're going to get to that 66%, we don't need to serve our Alpha, Bright, and Skyline Olympus kids. Those kids have, a lot of those kids do, but there's a percentage of them that need it. We need our lower income. Those are the kids we're not reaching, our first generation, our minority, and our women.
And we've got a question for Commissioner Burkholder.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious about the gender breakdown in any of the information that you've given us.
So the gender breakdown, when we look at it, in our overall numbers, so our 90% of applying and all of that, it's pretty even. Because we reach every kid. That was our purpose when we came to that. Different schools do it a lot of different ways. Ours was that we need every single kid to have their seat in a chair with help to do it. If we just say, come and apply, they're not going to do it. We're going to get the same thing. So we take them class by class, one English class at a time. So we get a pretty good, that's every student. We're getting a pretty good gender breakdown there. But our attendance when we look at it, our female populations are enrolling more than our male, but they're not complete. And so that's where we're looking at from our standpoint, and I, again, have a maybe slightly biased view because I feel very strongly about my girls that I work with, and I obviously care a lot about that population. That's part of my, where I've worked with, and a lot of my work has been done. And so I think a lot of what I've seen just from experience is that as with any student, there isn't a plan. So many girls, you ask, well, what's your plan? What are you going to do? I don't know. I'm going to get married. But being married is not a career. Being married is not a career. Well, I'm going to be a mom. Well, I'm a mom, but that's not the only thing I do. If that's what you want to, that's the only thing you're going to do, how are you going to build a life that supports yourself for that? I don't know. Okay, well, how about you go to college until you figure that out? have a backup plan, and that's what I've worked so hard with my populations to say, okay, that's great, and if that's your aspiration and that's what you want to be as a mom, that's okay, that's a noble career. But looking at the economic data in the state of Utah especially, most families are two-parent workers, and most women do work at some point. So how can we set goals? How can we pick a career? How can we choose a pathway? And that's where I think that gap is that and a lot of it is time. I can be perfectly honest with you that it's time. I have 400 kids, and I would love that if I could sit down. When I was coaching, it was fantastic. Because coaching, I have 30 girls, and those 30 girls, of my 30 girls, kids that would have never went to college. I had girls doing all kinds of things, because why would I be in their head 24 hours a day? I mean, I coach girl team, which is one of the most competitive sports in the state of Utah. So I have those girls far more than their parents did. I saw them for 4 to 6 hours, 6 days a week. So I could be in their head all the time. And I was like, what are you doing? Where are you going? Where are we going to be? I'm like, dance is nothing. I don't care about dance. How are you going to go to college? Like, what are you going to do when you grow up? What do you want to be? What are you passionate about? Think about it, you know? It was great. I would love if I could do that with my 400 students. But the reality of that is it isn't. And they slipped through the cracks. And it was frustrating. This was my first graduation as a counselor. Then lots of graduation, and I was heavily involved in graduation committees and all that as a teacher. But there is a different perspective of ownership as a counselor. And it was hard. It was a hard day as I'm passing out my kids' treat as they're bringing in their graduation application, and we're having the congratulations, and I'm like, hey, so you've applied, what's next, what's here? And some of my very, very bright students that had, you know, great GPAs and great ACT scores were like, I don't know, I think I'll go to SLIT. Like, the Salt Lake Community College is like the end-all be-all for Prince High School. And they're like, well, I think I'll go to SLIT. I'm like, you think? Like, it's June 4th. Like, how did we not, you know? And it was frustrating to feel like I failed, that they didn't come in and say, I'm doing this, and I have this, and this is what I'm going to major in. And, you know, and it's not a perfect world. That's not going to happen all the time. But I think we could be better at that. And I think we could provide students with a pathway. I was fun and tricky that I went to a conference and I had all of this like, oh, I've got to do better, and what can we do, and how can we reach these kids? And there was a gentleman who it's called the Southwest Pathways. And the Southwest Pathways Convention was held in Arizona. What they did is they're taking business owners and teachers and counselors and everybody and trying to create pathways for students. How can we get them to make choices from 9th grade to 12th grade so that they don't know exactly, yes, I'm going to be this when I grow up, but they know what they're interested in. They know their skill set. They know what they're good at. They know where that will translate. And he had this epiphany quote to me that I'm like, that's exactly what I've been fighting for the last 6 months, is that, you know, we are not preparing our middle-class students for middle-class jobs. And we know that we don't class jump. It doesn't happen often. We don't often leave where we're comfortable. We don't say, oh, you know what, I grew up in Kearns, and I'm going to go, you know, do this, and I'm going to become this, and I'm going to be this. Yes, few students do. There are. But that's this much of our percentage. This much of our population is going to stay in Kearns or West Valley or Magna or wherever, but we need to prepare them for a career that they can live a happy and healthy lifestyle where they're at. And I think we're having a difficult time finding that place, and I can see as counselors, there's a little bit of that. I went to college. I think education is amazing. And beaten into my kids' brains. My little boy, if you ask him where he's going to school, he'll tell you he's going to Stanford. And my husband's like, yeah, Danny, okay, that's great. But that day he gets accepted to Stanford, how are you going to pay for that? And I was like, I don't care. I will sell my house. I will work 4 jobs. If he goes, great. Like, you know, and of course, that is how I feel about education. But I also have to look at it from a realistic standpoint. And I think that's where it's difficult, is I want my students to go to college. I want them to... I'm a first-generation college student. My dad works for Salt Lake City, and my mom works as a customer service agent at a printing agency. I mean, they are both blue-collar workers, and I stepped outside the box, and I went, and I did more, and I obviously think, oh, every kid can do that. Come on, you're a kid from West Valley. I'm a kid from West Valley. You can do more, but the reality is that's not going to be great for every kid. So we need to look at, when we look at, you know, we have colleges come. We have the post-high school tour. It's called the post-high school tour. And all of the colleges come to the high school, and they set up booths, and our kids get to pick three of them, and they go for 20 minutes into the room and listen to them talk. Well, that's great, but obviously 70% of my kids are getting nothing from that, because 70% of my kids are not attending those schools. And we have Salt Lake Community College, who all my kids, that's where they're comfortable, that's what they like. But Salt Lake Community College tells us about how you can get a degree that will transfer to any colleges in Utah, the University of Utah, to UVU, to all of these. They don't talk to my kids about, they have this amazing certificate program. They have an amazing certificate program where kids can go through and be an apprentice and learn to be a plumber or an electrician, and they can make $60,000 a year, or then they could go on and go get a degree and make $100,000 a year. But kids don't see that. We hear nothing about that. My kids don't hear that.
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay, Greg Henderson. Yes.
And thank you, Janet, for your presentation and for your amazing work with these kids. And I share your sentiments. I have four daughters, and so I feel very strongly about empowering our girls.
Yeah.
All of them. All children, but especially the girls, should maybe feel a little bit, maybe lack that vision for whatever reason. I want to ask you, the kids who are going to college but not competing, what do you perceive the problem to be? Is it a financial problem, or is it just a visionary thing?
Visionary. Okay. I think it's that, and that's where, for me, it's a tough sell to swallow, because that's my job. My job is just to give kids a vision, and it's I don't think it's happening. It is, and on paper, we are killing ourselves trying to get these kids, but there's a gap somewhere, and that's what right now I'm, grasping at everything I can to find where is this gap and how can I fix it to get kids to just better understand, because I think, if we all think about ourselves, why did we go to college? Why did we do what we do? Or how did we end up where we ended up? And, when we were 16, 17, 18 years old, it wasn't the same. We didn't know. We changed. We grew. We evolved. But I think that knowing where your skill set is, and that's kind of where we really need to work and our work needs to be done, and letting kids know there are other choices. They see such a limited amount. I think they don't understand the possibilities of what's available to them. They don't understand, there's such a shortage of nurses right now. That's my sister-in-law's a nurse, and they're always trying so hard to get people, and there was a huge influx, and now we're clear back down again. And, I don't think kids see that, oh, wow, that's a great career choice. I could go be a nurse, and this is an awesome trip career choice, and we have all these things that are available. We have what's called the Granite Technical Institute. So our students are able to go. We have a separate building at our district building where kids can go. We have a medical assisting program. We have a CNA program. We have a dental assistant program. We have computer programming. We have construction trades. We have all of these things where kids can go take classes, and a lot of them they can be certified when they finish. But then I think, again, we're not giving them that little extra push that they're like, oh, I'm a medical assistant, and I make $12 an hour. This is a great job, which, from what they're used to, it feels like a great job. But then you need that extra little push of, you could continue on a little more, and it's going to become a career. It's not just a job. And I think that there's a gap there of finding what kids are good at and letting them know that being a doctor or a teacher or a lawyer are not our only three options in post-high school education. Those aren't the only things that we go to college for. And college is an umbrella of things. And we have posters everywhere, and we talk about the 1-4, and we do all of that. But I think that, it's been, 6 years since this whole initiative started, and we really decided college and career readiness, that we aren't high school counselors. We aren't talking about that. We're talking about preparing kids for career and college readiness. That is our job. That is our mission. And I think in that 6 years, we've come a long way with the college application weeks, with the post-high school tours, with getting kids college awareness starting in kindergarten. In our school district, our kindergartners come, and they're the class this year, they were the class of 2027. and they buy them a t-shirt, and they get to come, and they wear their t-shirt that says class of 2027, and we do this huge, big assembly for them at Kearns, and get them, like, hey, you're going to graduate, and then afterwards, and try to talk about that, and all of that is amazing work that's been done. But I think now we see, okay, we're seeing the data. It takes years to get that, and we're seeing the data. But now we need to see, okay, we've got this kid, but how do we now include all students, and kind of that. And I do believe that there are things that we can do, and I think there are many programs and initiatives and things we're working to do, but it's going to take time, and it's going to take more voices and more people saying, hey, this needs to happen, and changing our perception. Because sitting in this room, you are all very strong, accomplished women. It's amazing. But probably when you think of college, like we say, it's hard to shift that view, because for our children or our grandchildren or our neighbors or children that we love, we think, I got to go to college. We want them to go to college, and we want them to be so successful. So even our mindset is that we push kids in that direction when not the best for every kid. Kids can make great careers for themselves.
Jennifer Seelig has permission for the has a question for you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you for being here today.
Okay.
Yeah. So as part of your response to the HIT Senator, you had mentioned that this obviously is your job, and you're trying to provide a vision or help young people reach this vision. I also think that no matter what you do in many cases, the family and neighborhood and community of origin are so important and in many, many ways can complete and totally undermine what it is that you are doing as an individual that the school system and other things can do. I mean, on one hand, it could be undermining. It could also be enhancing. It could be independent critical thinking based on particular families or values of the family or a community. My point is, how are we working to help get families or neighborhoods engaged in this process to even to ask the question, what is your vision for your future? Because that's not superseding any family value. That's not superseding anything with a community. That's just asking the question and getting people to plan. So are there opportunities for partnerships available that help amplify the asking of that question? How can we help facilitate those partnerships? And how can we help educate parents too? Because from personal experience, so it's one case study, but where I have seen children, brilliant children, undermined, it's because the parents out of fear or just not going to college themselves, not understanding what that is or how that can help or get people connected to a technical school. So how can we provide parents the tools that they need to be able to ask that question too?
And that's a really great question, because that's a whole other piece of this pie. And I had a great opportunity. My district sent me to the National School Counseling Conference in Phoenix just 2 weeks ago. And that was one of the things that I really, and even our state conference that was put on by the Utah State Office of Education at the beginning of June that I attended, we're really working on that component, the parent component, and how we can get parents involved. And like you said, there is a difficulty there because you don't want to step on parents' toes. There are values that are created within families, within communities, within cultures that I can't come in and say, you know what, it's the best thing for you to send your daughter away to college. Because I think that did wonders for me to get ripped out of West Valley and thrown into Cedar City and have to figure my life out. But, you know, for some of these people, that's not okay. That's not, you know, for whatever reason, they have this belief that they need to keep their children there. And so I think that, like you said, we talk a lot about, and as a school and as a district, what we can do to empower our parents. and to get our parents on board for this. And it is difficult. It's difficult in our demographic to even see a parent because they're working. And it's not always, I think there's the misconception with a lot of, I've seen it, I've been 10 years, I lived in this demographic in 10 years working, that parents, oh, parents don't care. Our kids, their parents just don't care. No, they do care. But when they're working two jobs, they care about feeding their kids. And so we're trying to make that switch, but also when we talk about, we have our United Way partnership, which is a great community outreach. And so what we've talked about is, you know what, we need to have a counselor at every single event that's held. If it's the mobile eye clinic, you know what, our mobile eye clinic was insane. Like, they did a mobile eye clinic, and we had two full days of parents and kids, and most of them were parents that came in to get eyeglasses for their younger children or for themselves. It wasn't even our high school students. And so we said, you know, we need to have a counselor at those things. Just, hey, we're here to talk. We're here to answer questions. At our, we also have a Hispanic Parent Center, where, because a lot of our population is either English as their second language or they're non-English speakers, so we have a parent center set up in our school that's kind of like their, for lack of a better word, safe place. That they know, instead of coming into my office, that I'm a white English-speaking female, that they have to try to navigate this system, they can go there first and learn how to navigate the system in a language they're familiar with, a culture that they're familiar with. So they hold a meeting once a month, and we have a counselor at that meeting. We, as a school, it's been amazing because we now have two Spanish-speaking female counselors, which is awesome. We just hired a counselor, so I'm so excited. She's a first-generation manufacturer. Parents are immigrants from Mexico. And she's a native Spanish speaker. She is a first-generation everything. So we have these things, and trying to place them, we talk about at parent teacher conference, we can't be in our offices. We need to set up booths in the hallway, booths in the where the parent teacher conferences are going on, just like you said, to open the dialogue and get parents thinking. And I've gone to several presentations about community outreach programs, and starting how can we get like a parent next, where we're talking about not just about college, but hey, we're going to provide dinner. A lot of times if we provide dinner and babysitting and say, hey, we're going to give you information about your students. We're going to help you with your kids, because a lot of times it's not that they don't want to. It's just unfamiliar. And when things are uncomfortable, we tend to not do it.
So to that end, and I appreciate all the innovation that you all are doing and recognizing that we can't fit everyone into our conception of an institutional box. Are there counselors available at sporting events? Are we reaching out to the business and manufacturing community so that instead of asking people to come into our institutions, are we going out to where people are actually working? Because I get it. If you can't pay your rent, your mortgage, or feed your family, the rest of it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it doesn't matter.
And so how are we doing that?
And we're working, like, the FAFSA completion. That's another big initiative. Like, we have... they started a new thing that will start in Grant School District in the 14-15 school year, that, like you said, reporting events. Because that's what we said. Where are our parents? We need to go where our parents are, not expect our parents to come to us. And a lot of times, yeah, our parents will try to make a way to get to their kids. So at every sporting event, we have PSAs that have been created about FAFSA completion. They're going to be going out there, finding local Utah celebrities to read them and have them recorded, and that's the process we're in right now. And those will play at all sporting events. I know in Grant School District, we would like them to be bigger, but in our district that right now, those will run there. We've talked about that, yeah, like the businesses, and that's where we're talking about, okay, we know, for example, I can say, for like basketball, like I said, that we need to get out to where if we can have a counselor, they're getting their taxes done at the TurboTax station at Walmart. We need to have a school counselor there. If we can have a school counselor at, you know, any given thing in the evening, or where are they coming to, or what are they doing, and this is, again, like you said, new information. That's why it's all our hope of what we can do, because it does. You're exactly right that we have to have a complete paradigm switch, and that's kind of the place I'm in right now, and where I've been trying to get my voice heard and I'm one tiny boy from Kern High School, but trying to get, not just in the counseling world, but everywhere to say, hey, we need to know that this is a different job. And a lot of that, too, in, you know, when we have full disclosure, it's difficult. It's difficult to tell counselors that are already overworked and overstressed and underpaid to say, hey, PS, you have to donate 4 hours of your time tonight to go sit at TurboGas, or you need to, you know, because the money isn't there. We are not compensated for it. We work over, like, for us, anything we do at night, we're not paid for. So when we do that, we're not getting paid. And people, yes, it's something I'm passionate about. I've committed my life to education. I've done that. But it was. That's why I'm not coaching right now. I had to step back. I had to step back and say, wait, I have 2 children who I'm not doing anything for. Yes, I am impacting 30 children. But my husband had to say, hey, Danny, you're the mom of these 2. Those 30 have some type of parental figure. You're the one to this one. And it is hard to find, to say, okay, you have to give time away from your family, or you have to do this to go do that. And for most people, what I found when I've been like, hey, let's do this, like, because I am the young, excited, yay, I love this, let's do it. They're like, well, are you going to pay me to do it? I'm like, well, I know I have no money. I can't pay you. Yeah.
So, again, you've got Samira Escamilla, who is joined us, and she has a question for you. So.
Hi.
Thank you. Danny, and thank you for the work you do. One, maybe I have a more of a technical question on your experience. A couple of months ago, we had presentations here about STEM, and it was mostly women in engineering, or the few women in engineering. And there was some data that was still impacted me in terms of understanding how young girls in grade school, per se, like, you know, first grade to seventh grade or middle school, are better than boys in math, engineering, science. And then when they go to high school, nothing. I mean, something happened. Not that they dropped their grades, it's just there's a disconnect. Then they don't enter into those programs. So a lot of it was a conversation about counselors. And I want to know, from your professional perspective, what are counselors doing to promote women in those type of careers? One, and if that's not happening, is that a fault of the training and education that you guys are getting as counselors in your bachelor's degree programs or master's degree programs? I mean, where is it that we're failing? Because we're disconnecting women there, or young women in this case, and there's no answer. We don't have the boys tend to go directly to STEM programs, no questions asked, and somehow the girls get disconnected. And the only component of, you know, let's say someone that is guiding them is the guiding, you know, the counselor.
Yeah.
So if you don't mind answering that, and then I do have a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
So now you're going to really get me standing up and screaming really loud, that you're going to get my crazy feminist side coming out. But no, I'm reading an amazing book right now that is called...
You're the right group.
Yeah, I know. That's why somebody told you I'm here. Because I told you I googled you all. And I was like, you mess my people. Like, I'm reading this amazing book right now. And it's called Girls in Power. And the author spoke at the National School Counseling Conference. And she was incredible. And it's about that. It's about that we have girls. And as young girls, we are very confident. We are smart. We are capable. We are able. We do everything. And then all of a sudden, we get about 12 years old, and all of a sudden, we hate ourselves. We get everything about ourselves, and we do nothing in life. And that is solely based on our self-esteem, our self-concept, and that perception of self that we get, and the perception that the world is giving us. And we're getting better, we are, but it's still there, and it is a fight, and people think I'm crazy, but it is right now one of those things where I say, in my school, and I can only speak for myself, and I'm trying really hard to push it out to the masses, and that's why I'm reading and researching and doing all this. So we do a monthly professional development with all of our counselors, and I want to be very well versed and educated so I can go to my director and say, hey, I need to talk to our counselors about girls. And I need to say this because it is. And I hear it every day, the comments that are made, the voices that are being heard. Girls don't know. And this section of the book is amazing that it's like, you know, that their self-concept
She like breaks it down. So like self-confidence at that age is based upon, it goes self-confidence equals being pretty, and pretty equals being skinny, and skinny equals being sexy. And that's what girls feel. And that's what they think. And her research is based solely on what I like about her perspective. Is she's like, I have spoken, we all, counselors, psychologists, teachers, parents, everybody, and we all say what we think girls are feeling and what they know because we've been girls, right? Well, we have no idea what their life is like. So she, her studies are based on thousands and thousands of girls that over an 8-year period she sat down with and spoke with to see, hey, what's going on? Tell me about your life. Tell me about what's hard. Tell me about what you're good at. Tell me what you like about yourself. And go from there. And I think that, like you said, I think it is based upon self-confidence. That girls don't think that it's cool to be smart. Girls don't think that it's cool to be any of that. Girls think that you should be pretty and skinny. And if you're not, stuck.
What's the name of the book you said was Girl in Power? Because we're not.
No, it's yet. Called, hold on. Let me get this. Let me get my notes out. Maybe that's what her speech was called.
And then here we have to meet each other here.
Thank you. And I think to the commission, I continue to have this, that may help answering a component of that question, but I'm still, you know, maybe we need to explore more, you know, just from what can we more proactively do through the counseling programs at those high schools so those girls can get, you know, I mean, is there a systematic issue that we need to address, whether it's through curriculum where they get trained, and most of them are, I don't know, bachelor's in social work. I mean, I'm not an expert on that area, but anyway, so I try and put that on the commission's list because that could be something that could literally make a 180 on the lives of young women, whether they enter into a STEM program or not. And here we are investing in all this STEM education, but somehow we're missing them on that application process. I mean, my second question is with regards to the PACE program. I believe current high school is. It's part of the Tulsa Community College and the University of Pennsylvania all tied up, and they have almost a case management component on, you know, first generation students, females, minorities, to help them through their, you know, the high school piece. And they mentioned they're only working Title I high schools, Tulsa Community College and the University. I'm not sure if parents are in there.
We're not a Title I school, but Granger High School is. And so that, but we also partner with the University of Utah. We do a similar program, kind of like that, that we have our students that come in, it's called Gear Up.
And
Upward Bound and all that. And we do that, but yeah, we're not Title I.
Oh, so your case is not going to be there.
So, okay. Case, so we don't get the funding for that without being in.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
I would be interested that maybe our research committee can help us with this moving forward, because we've read a couple of articles related to the interaction between teachers and other authority figures in schools and girls that are in that age level that Senator Escamilla mentioned, that it's not overt in terms of the way that they interact with students, but there are subversive ways where either they talk, young women aren't called on as frequently when in a classroom setting as young men are. And other things that, again, that are not intentional on the teacher's part necessarily, but since they're not intentionally looking at ways of bringing up young women in their classroom, that's what happens, is that the young women perceive, okay, well, I've raised my hand 3 times, I'm not getting called on, that means that my voice is not valued, that means that I obviously don't know what I'm talking about in this class, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm wondering if there is an effort within in-service training and professional development with teachers of having them be very, very overt about thinking about, well, how do I run my classroom? How am I having conversations within the classroom with young women and with young men, and how do I raise up those young women that I see that have great capabilities of shining within my classroom? And you know, again, that, I think that that's what, in answering your question, Senator Escamilla, maybe that's something we need to evaluate, is there something, because you're asking, is there something systemic, is there something societal that occurs within that middle school culture that reinforces for young women that we are, this is why I'm valued, this is how I'm valued, because the other things that I bring to the table that I brought to the table when I was in first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth grade are no longer valued in the same way.
Yeah,
so society places those on them by media and other things that they see and what's valued and what's not valued. But is there something happening within the context of this classroom setting that may also be reinforcing those young women's notions of this is why this is valued versus this?
Well, and that it's just, I think the biggest thing too, it's just not talked about. And that's what she said in the book, sorry, it's called Girls Without Limits. So it's called Girls Without Limits. And the woman who wrote this, also she was a counselor. She was then a counseling educator, at Ohio State University. And then she had a foundation called Ruling Our Experiences, or ROX. And that does have, part of that is that she now left her job to run this fully, because, and that is curriculum-based. I believe they do have curriculum, and they put out to try to see what we can do in this world to either stop that switch from happening or to help girls, because I think that it is completely, and from my experience of working with girls and all of that, is that, you know, when she speaks so much to this, that we feel, we have this idea that, okay, girls, we need to focus on girls. So then we think, oh, well, it's their self-confidence. So we believe that how we build a girl's self-confidence is we tell her she's beautiful. Tell her she's pretty and she's going to feel so good. Well, that does nothing, because guess what? Everybody else in the world isn't going to tell her that. Like, it's not going to happen. And it's such a false sense of self-confidence that we don't focus on teaching girls to know what they're good at and really focusing on their aspects and their skills. And, hey, you know what? Build their confidence by saying, not just you're smart, but you're so good at math, or you're such a great reader, and you know what that can translate into. And, you know, I can only speak from my personal experience, but it's true. You know, I mean, I did very, very well all through school. I was in upper programs. I did all that until I hit ninth grade. I was in all of these, and I hit ninth grade, and then all of a sudden, in high school, when it really mattered and was really important for me to be a part of all this, I didn't do any of it. Because why? Because no one told me that I should. And it kind of dissipated, and it wasn't cool to be the smart girl. And it wasn't cool, but it was really cool for me to be on girl team, you know, which did so much for my life. No, it didn't. It did nothing.
Well, thank you. Just more of a comment. I wanted to just put this out there. And I know then you said that for at least the population that you serve, cost isn't necessarily an issue with staying in college, but I imagine that it's a significant issue for a lot of people.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to draw some attention. I don't know if you guys have seen this or not, but the state auditor just released a report last week that talks about the level of subsidization that occurs with the NCAA in our colleges and universities here in the state of Utah. And there's a breakdown of every single state-run institution that affiliates with the NCAA and the level of subsidy that other students have to pay to subsidize that, having that NCAA program and an athlete at the school. And it's pretty significant. So at your Southern Utah University, last year, the subsidy for every single student who wasn't affiliated with the NCAA or with athletics had to pay an extra $1,164.90 in tuition and other costs.
It's insane. Like, it, and I think, like you said, the cost there is, and that we don't see, for kids, I think that they don't understand the cost of college. And I don't think, you know, there's a break of, first of all, like you said, college is expensive, or why? Like, why? And we're trying to get that, and I can see, but then there's these other pieces of our ability to pay for college has completely changed. When I went to school, obviously I was a first-generation college student, came from a low-income area. And as I just told you, full disclosure, I didn't do what I should have done in high school. I didn't graduate with the accolades I probably could have and got the scholarships I did. I have a scholarship for Southern Utah University, but I had to keep a 3.9 GPA to get that scholarship. So what happened? I lost my scholarship the first semester I was at school. And
then what did I do? My parents couldn't pay for college. They couldn't do anything. I had a job-ish, but I lived in a college community, so I took out a student loan. And you know what? It was great. It was great at that point. I still pay for my student loan, and I have a 0.4 interest rate on my student loan. It was great, but that's not there anymore, and kids don't have that fallback. And so that's where, like, that FAFSA, that they're not, and I think if they don't have a solid plan and they don't want to be at college, the cost is, yes, they're going to be like, oh, it's too expensive, and it's too hard, it's too this. But if they have a direction and it's, we're going to finish, you know, I think there's so many components, and it is a broken system. I think that UC and higher education is amazing, but I also think that there are pieces of it that we aren't focusing on the right aspects of it. We're not focusing on the majority of our kids, which are now our minority, our low-income, and our women. We're focusing on, we've really got that target population, but that target population is not our majority.
Well, and everybody else is paying for
that. Yeah, paying for it.
I mean, some kids are going to school. Policymakers here just need to keep this in mind. I mean, if we're looking at, you know, why, what are the reasons why women aren't finishing college? Well, cost clearly is one reason why women kept in. I mean, that's why I dropped out of school after I got married and had to support two jobs to put my husband through, and I'm still trying to catch up from all of that. So, you know, it cost is a significant issue, and as we look at, you know, why are costs, you know, what are the costs, and who is paying those costs, and what is, you know, what are we subsidizing? I don't know much about the NCAA, but I don't, are there any women involved in that?
There are four programs. But in terms of the numbers, I mean, proportionally.
Title IX. Through Title IX, I read that same audit, and Title IX does require that equal numbers of female and male athletes at a collegiate level, and so those dollars are distributed equally to each of the athletes. Across the board, male and female. But, I mean, your point is that's
incredible. It costs significantly for everybody else.
And so it's just something
to think about, and I don't know how you solve the problem, because sports are a good thing, you know, but
it's not a career path. That's what we try to teach our kids too. When they get to the college, you need to educate them first. This is a way to pay for your college. It is a recreational activity that pays for you to obtain a career. And that's a hard, and having been a coach, it's hard. It's hard because, yeah, when you're in the middle of a game, you're not thinking like, you're thinking, I'm going to win, like, you know, but it's really not. Like I said, an amateur skills team, which is the most insignificant nothingness in the world, that it was one of the most competitive sports that does nothing at the collegiate level. So but, you know, it is true. It's true that we have to find these places because, yeah, your average girl or boy who's going to college and is unsure and unaware, and I know they're doing, I just got a job posting for Southern Utah University that the same thing, it's always about money. It's, you know, I job posting for, they're getting five new, I think they're calling, I don't know what they're calling, they're like academic advisors, pretty much, but they're calling something different. They're running this new program because they need retention, and they need this, and our kids aren't staying in college, and what are we going to do? And it's going to pretty much be like a school counselor at the college level for our freshman students and help them get a pass. It's an amazing job, and I was like, oh, man. I'm like reading through it, and I'm like, I gotta stop reading this because I maybe move myself down to your city again. Like, reading, and then I look, and it's like, the salary is $33,000. I'm like, I am a high school counselor, and I make more than $33,000. Like, I'm not gonna leave my high, which is not a heavily paid job, and no one's gonna leave that to go do that. Where I think there's always a money component, which is hard because, yeah, then why is money not going to that to pay a salary for someone who's going to do retention? We're paying tuition towards a sport.
To make the comparisons between counselors and athletic directors would be an intriguing type of discussion.
Yeah, that is.
Talking about priorities.
Danny, before we want to tie up some of the discussion here, I think what I would like to ask you is if you could give us one or two or even three
short-term fixes that you see that we as members of this commission can make a difference in, especially those of us that are policymakers, like maybe short-term ones and then maybe one or two, this is where we need to be 5-10 years from now. I mean, to reach the objectives that we're looking at, especially with the growing minority majority population we have, this is what your goal should be, but these are the short-term things that I can see that we can start making a difference in from your perspective.
Okay, I think that first and foremost, one of the biggest things, and especially obviously with the group I'm speaking with, policymakers, you're the ones who decide how many counselors there are. You decide how they're paid and what happens. And reality is, we need more school counselors. And that equates to money. We need more counselors. A ratio of 400 to 1 is not productive. It is not. You can see I'm extremely passionate about my job. I love what I do. I will work 14 hours a day if I have to. But not everyone is like me. And it's not going to happen. And even for me, it's difficult because I have to find my stopping point. Because I did choose to have my own family and to do those things which need me to. And I think that's where everybody's asking. First and foremost, school counseling needs to be on the forefront, the thoughts, the minds of policymakers, of, you know, educators, of that. And we have this amazing opportunity that, you know, we have this governor's initiative, but it's very rarely has school counseling been a component of that initiative. Mm-hmm. When, in my opinion, slightly biased opinion, we're the change makers. We're the ones that we're going to be that 66%. That's going to be because of us, but nobody talks about us, our profession, what we're doing, and how they can make that better and easier. And I'm sorry, that's really blunt, and you're all awesome and amazing, but yeah, that's a huge thing for me. And I'm not saying that I need to make more money. That's not, I think I'm paid well for the job that I do, but I think we need more of me. We don't need 400 to 1. National ratio through the National Association of School Counselors should be 250 to 1. In order for our schools to be what are called ramp schools, which if we want to go, it's called the American School Counselor Association, so AFCA. And in order to be, they have a thing called a ramp school, which is like you are like a do-and-is school, best of the best. In order to be one of those, you have to meet the national average, and that is 250 to 1. The state of Utah, we are at 400 to 1 in our school counseling. Most schools, some are, now are we doing better than other states? Yes. Arizona, where I just went, 700 to 1 in their public schools. Okay? Horrible. And that's why, if you've noticed, if you haven't watched the First Lady's speech to school counselors at the National School Counseling Conference last year, which I was so bummed because, of course, this year she did not attend, so I missed that, but watch it. It's amazing. Her just speech, and that is part of a national thing that she's trying to get awareness involved in. We're pushing through, but awareness of school counseling is first and foremost that needs to happen. So I would say that's my number one. We need to be aware of school counselors. We need to know what they're doing, how they're doing it, and how we can better help them. The other thing is pathways. We have got to focus on pathways. We need kids to know what they're doing, and we need to start early. And we have programs, and we're rolling it out, and we're trying, and that's going to take a while, and we're going to have to see where that goes. But I think we need to continue that in those pathways, when we start in the seventh grade, we need to show kids that there is more availability than usually. There's more availability.
So the Utah Futures Program, isn't that addressed, or is it just a small team? Yeah, because it's so college-focused, for your college-focused.
I talked about this a little bit at the other one. Utah Futures was not existing for a long time, and we did nothing with Utah Futures. Utah Futures wasn't in school counseling until, apparently, it is new and improved and ready to roll out again. And the summer conference that I just went to, they just had a session on the new, improved Utah Futures. Because it was down for, I think it went down for like a year or so, and so it just went off everybody's radar. We couldn't use it, we stopped using it, and in a fast-paced career that we have, we can't like, we just changed our curriculum, went to something different, and started a different direction. And I think now it's getting everybody back to like, okay, now Utah Futures is working again. We got
it. So we've been working a bit with that and have had some concerns ourselves with that. That's why I asked about that. And if you could just kind of keep us apprised of how that coming to you from your perspective as a college, as a school counselor, you know, because we've had this promise, okay, we reboot it, we've given them additional funding and one more chance to kind of figure this all out. It's now over within UEN, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm thinking maybe we should plug in with you in another year or so to just kind of see,
yeah,
is that working now for you? Are you able to access that information? Are you able to access what you need as a counselor and your colleagues? So
yeah, and when I looked at it, I did a quick overview of it, and it seemed okay. And I think it's just a matter of, again, getting it out to the masses. And that's something, too, that within my district, if it's a big push, I mean, and I appreciate you letting us know, too, like, hey, well, we're going to need you top users, you know? And it's like I told Representative Edwards, I think sometimes we have this up here, making policies and programs and initiatives and all this, and we have us working down here, but they're not getting the same ideas. What it was expected to be is not happening here, and what we're expecting is not being created. And so it's kind of, there's that disconnect there. But if Utah Futures is, this is it, this is what we're going to do, use Utah Futures, see where it works, then I can do what I can, especially in my district, to say, hey, let's push this out. Let's do this, so then in a year I can go back and say, it's great, it's horrible, or it's fine, but we like something else. And I will work on that.
Can I ask that you, I mean, based on, and this particularly the legislators in the room, the appetite for increasing education funding in the state is not there, as we know, and counselor and increasing counselors and their compensation, that's likely a part of the bigger picture, right, the whole package. I think that Utah Futures is a way to help increase your bandwidth, and it is maybe a more likely solution. Can I offer my help in reaching out to Utah Futures to be maybe a liaison with the commission to get some of the information that we would like to see in the actual program? My vision when we first started this commission was to have a video targeting young girls that were using Utah Futures to talk to them about stats, because I think a lot of the problem with young girls is that they don't see the bigger picture, but if the bigger picture is told to them in a way that they can relate to, I think would be really important. And I'm just volunteering to be that person, and I don't know who at UEN I need to get with, but I'd like to do that.
Okay, and work on getting that information. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for offering that.
So, and I'll work on that too. But I think that needs to be, and that's something that I can say, like, from us, that's something that we need to work on, and that I've seen in the gap in our career and in our counselors and throughout the state, is that those pathways and creating those and making sure that kids have good, solid thoughts of not, I think we focus on, remember, what do you want to be? What do you want to be? A horrible question to ask a 15-year-old. Mm-hmm. They have no idea. They don't know what they're going to wear tomorrow. They don't know. And so they get overwhelmed by that question, and then they feel like, well, if I don't know what I'm supposed to do, then I'm not going to be doing anything. And so I think focusing more on what Utah Futures may help with a little bit is their skills. What are you good at, and how does that translate? Here's a whole list of hundreds or 50 or 20 careers that you're good at this, and this. And you're not so great at this and this, but that's okay because these careers take this. Like, you know, I'm a really good reader, but I'm not great at math, so anything with math intimidates me. Well, okay, but that doesn't mean I haven't been successful in my life. That doesn't mean I didn't receive a master's degree. I got through school just fine, even though I've been intimidated by math, you know? And so I think to get kids to see, you don't have to be great at everything. And what is your skill set? And here are these careers that they translate to. And, you know, they may be different. I was a teacher for X number of years, and now I'm a counselor. I found going through teaching where my skill set better fit, you know, kind of there. So I think for me, those are big things. Those are my two right now. And then obviously the girl issue is a huge one for me. That's just my side note project that happens to fit very well with all of your initiatives. That obviously that's why I'm reading and researching and trying to be in contact with different people, because I do think that we need to, I'm just raising a daughter. It's just a hard end working with girls. I see the really sad things that are happening. So I appreciate that there is a commission and that we're working to empower women. And not that, you know, I think
I don't feel like I'm oppressed. I don't feel like, oh, I have never got a job because I'm a woman. Or I don't. But I do feel like the perception is really skewed in those middle to high school years, and that's affecting girls and women and taking them longer to get into these careers and find themselves. And most women that are entering these upper level careers and this stuff is happening later on in their lives because it's taking them longer to get out of that pretty skinny, sexy self to smart, strong, that. So I think those are things that just where I would like to see things in the next 5 to 10 years. Like I said, one of the biggest things is that I hope that we can have school counseling on the forefront, that we can understand the role of a school counselor, that school counselors can understand the role of a school counselor, and the impact that it has on our youth, and the impact that it is going to have on our society, our community, our state, because they are it. This is it, and we've got to find ways to push kids and to show them that they can do different things and be things and to fill the gaps, because our construction trade, that's where, when I came and spoke, that is who has been in my business every second since I spoke in April, is construction trade. Because they're like, we need kids. We don't have kids. We don't have kids. We don't have them. We need them. And, I mean, that can be a part, too, to show women. Like, women in the construction trade, like, you can have a great job. If you like to work with your hands and you like to do this, it's not, we use it as a fallback career. I think, you know, trades and construction, girls think when we say trade, boys are like, oh, I'm going to do construction, and girls are like, I'm going to do hair. Like, we have that disconnect there, that we need to show them there's more, and then feel pushed the hierarchy, because we need that too, but we also need everybody that falls under our upper level jobs, and then here and kind of fill in those gaps, and I hope that we can find places and that I can be, you know, a voice and work with the people to try to get where we need to be and make sure that everybody, legislature, educators, districts, and school counselors themselves realize the importance of their role. I don't know that people I work with, I don't even know that they realize their role. Because school counseling can be a really cush job if you want it to be. And I think for some people it is. So.
Well, Danny, thank you so much for your comments and your input. At another time, again, we're limited on time, but I'd love to talk to you a bit about the role that you have to play as a social worker. I mean, just kind of the challenge between what you've been asked to do as school counselor for college and career readiness versus a lot of what you're probably spending your time doing, which is navigating some of the societal and social challenges that young people face and going through their school day and how that might impede or be used as an opportunity to springboard them to some of these more optimal outcomes for them. So I think I'll give you respond. Anything that you want to add, Representative Edwards?
Just thank you. You've given us a lot of things to think about, and I think there are implications to all of us in our different spheres, whether that's business or policymakers. So thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. It's been an amazing opportunity to speak with you. And if you have my contact information, let me know, please. I would be happy to help you be a part of anything that I can do to, you know, push forward and to create the opportunities that we need to create for our youth and for our future. Okay.
I'm going to go ahead and move forward. We were going to spend some time letting the SIP committee separate and visit, and I'm trying to figure out with their time frame whether we should just allow people to do that or do we want to have folks do a quick report from their committees that they've met and then allow them to take the rest of the time to meet if they want to hear. What do you think?
Madam Chair, regardless of what's decided, I would appreciate it if the chair of the research committee could at least take 60 seconds to talk about where we are, because we are at a pivotal point, and this whole area of data was one of the driving forces behind this bill and getting good information about making good public policy. So
Let's allow every one of the committees to do a report, see where we're at, and then if people want to take some time upon adjournment of the collective commission to get together to either calendar their next meeting or to have discussions on next steps of what needs to be done, they can do that. So why don't we start with our research committee and we would do that. Commissioner Robinson.
Thank you. Appreciate the time. Our subcommittee has had a couple of meetings and we've worked through the research design of what we'd like to do. And essentially, we have a general question of looking at the experiences of Utah women. And we phased it into two components. Phase one would be focus groups across the state, and then phase two would be a statewide survey. Phase one, again, it's focus groups with women, and it would be employed women and not employed women. There would probably be seven mini focus groups for employed women and then seven mini focus groups for not employed women. And they'd be held in locations Logan, Salt Lake, Provo, Vernal, Salina, the St. George, Cedar City area, and the Kanab area are what we're thinking of. Right now, the office that I work for, the Center for Public Policy, is designing out a discussion guide or the questions that would be used in a focus group. And then we'll take that general discussion guide back to our research subcommittee and go through that as a group. I just want to compliment and thank all of the people that have been on that subcommittee. We have about two-hour meetings, and we've done several of them, and they are highly productive meetings with incredible input. And yeah, the University Federal Representative, you'll have to help me remember everybody. Utah State has two representatives. The University of Utah has several representatives.
Utah Valley.
Utah Valley, BYU. Did I capture everybody? Yeah. And then from our group, Amber Holder, Jennifer Seelig, myself, and Jerry Main are on there as well. Thanks. And then Labor's represented. Terrific group. We have priced out the cost for doing the focus groups, and I think I shared that by email with you as well. Part of the cost that's not included in this is the time that I would spend and some of my staff would spend. We're just going to subsidize that. So, just so you know that. But we would need the support to really carry out this and you have that price. And I don't know where we go from this point.
I think what I would recommend is, I believe that Carrie, you received that too. Did you receive the breakdown of the cost? I mean, the narrative or the case statement is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
In terms of asking for them, I believe Senator Escamilla that we included you in that mailing too, so you should have received that. If we could send that to all of the commissioners, because what we're looking for right now are funders. So if you can take a look at that narrative, you can look at the case statement, we'll send that out to you. If you can think of potential funders who could assist us in paying for those focus groups.
It's $40,000.
$32,000. So we'll have those discussions, because the sooner that we can get that funding underway, then the sooner we can get the focus groups going. Yes.
We're also working with Carrie to determine the provisions of the bill and also under state law and regulations how we can obtain external funding related to that in a way that's legal.
We'll have to do that.
We'll have to do
that.
To comply with all the regulations and oversight appropriately with the commission's implementation of those focus groups and funding thereof.
Yes.
Anything else from the research committee?
Members? No. We will examine that question you brought up earlier today about the unintentional acts of teachers or counselors that could impact female students. And there's some great researchers at the University and the College of Ed and the Utah Education Policy Center that might be able to help. So I'll just explore that.
It would just be intriguing to me, given what she was talking about and what Senator Escamilla brought up in terms of that middle school funk that kind of occurs when we lose so many young women and the potential that they could provide in terms of moving forward. And we don't, I mean, I'm sure that there's something, there are a variety of issues, including the ones that she brought up, but I think there's something a bit more systemic that we might want to cue into. Alrighty, thank you so much. Let's go ahead and move to the communications subcommittee. Commissioner Wallace.
So at our last meeting, I was
unanimously was chair of the communications committee.
Yay.
And did receive the information that we have used in the past for talking points, especially with Karen Fisher's 824 report on the wage gap. I have spoken with, just internally in our department, with our communications team so I can better understand the role of the communications team. I know that our committee has met already once when Heather was overseeing that and has already put out some of these things, including the talking points for ABC4 Utah. My three focuses will be on, obviously, messaging and talking points for any type of media opportunities that come up, and also responses to any reports that come out through the media, like we've seen, like the 24/7 Wall Street Report, and then also public community education. And that's one that we haven't really explored yet, but that might be a component that's more preemptive rather than reactive, what we're doing, and sharing with the community as well. So my steps moving forward would be to have our next meeting, and that includes those who have already served on the committee. And at that committee meeting, we were talking about who else to bring on that would bring certain type of experience or perspective. And we had talked about different groups that we wanted to reach out to. Some we're not able to provide somebody, but we will want to fill the rest of the seats in that. So by the next committee meeting, the next commission meeting, we shall have already had a commission, our committee meeting for communications. So that's my update. Any questions? Right. Oh, also one more thing. I would, and this will be probably more of a community thing, but I would like to have a co-chair. And it does not have to be a commission member to be a co-chair of that committee, somebody that does have experience of being a communications professional. So that's my plan.
So you're going to be researching, trying to recruit for that.
Yeah.
What's your
definitely. If you have any suggestions of a woman that has that kind of passion for what we're our, you know, I guess our initiatives are, that does have communications experience, I would love to hear about them.
So I'll report really briefly on our public policy committee. I'm going to pull up my notes. Because one of the first things we talked about actually ties with the work that you'll be doing, Commissioner Wallace, with the communications committee. And we were addressing the issue of being able to move forward with whatever policy recommendations or discussions that we have in informing what our research is finding out as we move forward with the focus groups as well as the literature review, but also information that we're gathering from our various meetings. That we've got some great information we heard today about the need for counselors and how that's so crucial in order to move forward our agenda. The discussions that we had last month with UCHI, or with the discussions that we've had with the engineers, the women's engineers group that came and talked to us and talked about the challenges within their sector of work. So one thing we wanted to give as an assignment of sorts, particularly to explore with the committee, the communication committee commissioner, is how we can start pushing out this information to the broader public. And you just mentioned that as your third item of focus for your group to work on, public outreach, public education. We talk about such great stuff in this commission, and we need to figure out a way to get that really pushed out, both within the mechanisms of the support that we receive from DWS, but in other veins also. I know that there's been a lot of attention paid to recently the Women's Leadership Institute that is being spearheaded by former Senator Pat Jones, and I think that there is a great niche for that particular organization, but I think that we meet a different need, and what I want to do is really find a way to differentiate and brand ourselves as what this commission is doing and what our focus is that might be different than what the WLI is doing at this present time. So especially as we move forward as policymakers and those that are going to be asking for reauthorization or expansion of this particular commission and allowing us to continue to do our work moving into the next session, we feel very strongly that we have to have that public presence really out there and showing that we're making some headway and also cascading the information that we're hearing from people in the community that are out doing the work to better improve women's presence in our state economy and flourishing. So that was one thing that we wanted to ask you to explore, and we can talk about that a little bit more offline. But that's the ideas we are awaiting, but think about that as you move forward. We talked a bit about something that we addressed at our last meeting, which was
a great presentation from Senator Escamilla, and I know that Senator Henderson has also worked really hard on this issue related to the interior designers and their licensure/certification issues and how to deal with us as a commission moving forward policy discussions. We need to do a bit more investigation since we are a executive branch commission as to how executive branch entities provide policy recommendations. We don't know whether we can take stands as our bills. We probably can. We're just trying to figure out what that process would look like since we're an entity that is established in statute, but our oversight or the work that we do is done in conjunction with an executive branch. So I'm going to have a conversation with the governor's office about that to find out how that happens. And then the other thing we thought about was, and this is maybe something that Commissioner Wallace could help us a bit with, how does the Chamber, I know the Chamber of Commerce does a really effective job, and a number of us were honored yesterday as business champions for the Chamber, but they identify policy recommendations and what bills they're going to focus on. I'm sure that given the fact that they represent a large part of the business community in the state of Utah, there's a lot of stuff they could focus on, but they narrow it down to a queue of a certain number of policies. How do they determine which ones they support, which ones they don't? And so what we'd like to do is find out how that's done, and maybe that might be a model to help guide us in terms of, do we do it by a principle statement? Do we have stated principles of what we decide to support or not support in terms of legislation? Or is there some other mechanism by which we would narrow down, this is a bill that we would support or something we would get behind or a appropriation request we should get behind, and that this is how the commission determines those decisions. So that's kind of where we're at right now, and I'm open to input from some of the other members that might have some thoughts on that.
Thank you. The only thought that comes to my mind immediately is, you know, as a lawmaker, I represent a constituency. I have to put their needs first, not the commission's recommendations first. You know what I mean? And so that's the only tricky thing with being on a commission that has policy, you know, take stands on specific bills, because when I vote, I have to think about my whole constituency and not, you know, and the needs and the, you know, the ideals, I mean, they may align most of the time, but anyway, I just want to put that out there that we all have that maybe conflict there.
That's good to know. And those are the things we're trying to work through of how do we take a stand on certain things as a commission when we do represent different constituencies, whether we're elected official or other organizations that may or may not be able to take a policy stance based on who they are. So we're still working through it. Thank you for providing that point so we can keep a pin in that and make sure that we're mindful of it. Yes, Senator Escamilla.
Maybe just going back to what Senator Henderson mentioned. So, I mean, you're talking about your personal vote, per se, on a specific legislation. So, I mean, the commission can take, you know, it sits by a majority, you know, simple majority, and you can be outnumbered if the commission takes a position. And, you know, it doesn't mean that you have to vote that way. I mean, I'm sure that's
right.
I mean, but I think that's pretty...
This is why
we're all like...
We're all, you know...
I mean, it makes sense. If, you know, personally, for X, Y, I mean, there may be many other reasons beyond your constituency why you would take a vote. You know, so... but it doesn't mean that... I mean, I think the commission having policy priorities is only going to empower them. My concern is, and you know, the chamber does it very successfully. I think it's probably one of the organizations that has more success when you have 87% rate of all the legislators lining up on your priorities. That obviously speaks volumes for that organization, and I don't know of any other organization that has that success rate except Solid Chamber of Commerce. So, and then, you know, we may not align with all of them. I mean, you know, individually as a legislator for many reasons. So to me, you know, I like the disclosure, but I think it's, you know, I think we all understand that. You know, your role as a state senator, you will have to see many, many other issues at the moment of the vote, and maybe, you know, you may have to take a different vote. But the commission is certainly based on a simple majority of what the members are
discussing because this was not a policy priority. But yeah, I mean, I agree. May not, we may not all agree as policy wise at the day of the vote on a specific issue. And, you know, I don't think that's different from any other work or any other board that you may belong to where they may take a position and you're not, you know, because of your district, because of many other things that you know as a senator, you can't be in that vote, you know, there. So, I mean, I think that's a good way, maybe self-explanatory for us as legislators, but, you know, I'm glad you mentioned it as well. But what I don't want is to stay shy from us as a commission to discuss real policy. Because where we get lost is, we can have hours of conversation, put it on the record, and no offense to DWF or to our website, but I know that everyone's going to read all our minutes, but real impact is when you say, this is why we think this is good public policy from a commission perspective, and why this is important, because people are tired. I mean, sure, this is a real issue. I just end up doing a presentation for Questar on women and disparities, and the more you read, the more you realize how much disparities they are. It's quite scary. Well, they're 52% of the population, right? I mean, we talk about closing that gap, but as the other group, for example, you have the other group that was mentioned, you know, that's spearheaded by former Senator Pat Jones, and their focus is so narrow. I mean, they do have a very narrow focus on upper management, you know, there are no leadership positions. That's like excluding 90% of women. I mean, that's a very good, which is needed. I mean, they're talking about executive boards and big corporations, vice president, president positions needed. I'm glad somebody's taking on it. But if you look at the vast majority of women in Utah, they're not in that, that little percentage of women that are struggling themselves to get there. We're still trying to get them out of high school. I mean, you know, our conversation is getting into college and not having the situation that was explained, you know, very well explained by the presenter before. So I hope that we don't shy away from a policy position, because I think that's very critical. And I'm glad that it also was explained that as legislators, we are also having to manage our position as senators or representatives that represent a specific district and many other interests that you have to take into consideration when taking a vote. But I must see, you know, it shouldn't be, to me personally, it's not a problem that, you know, you have to make the decision. Hopefully you'll be aligned with, you know, what I think is the right thing. Mm-hmm. Hopefully you'll vote for this whole thing. But, you know, I know it doesn't happen. It's just the nature of what it is, right? But, you know, I still think it's important that we push forward good public policy, because at the end that's what's going to be left behind as legacy. I mean, everything else would be great minutes, good powerful presentations, and that's it. I mean, I'm hoping we can leave some other type of legacy as well.
And since we're a commission and not like a legislative committee, there might be a way of putting together protocols for taking a position that would allow people to abstain, perhaps. I mean, those are some of the things we can explore. We can define for us as a commission how people can participate, and it's going to be different than legislative rules. So that's another thing we might want to think about.
Right, and I'm not suggesting we don't take public policy positions, and I agree. There are a lot of public policy areas that need improvement that you know, the interior design is just one example. I mean, I can think of, I had midwives come into me yesterday, and that's another area that I think that we should look at. So I don't agree that we should take, I just wanted to everybody's on the same page there. It's just because the commission is such a, if it stands one way, no one expects it.
It's not binding. It's an issue of binding votes here.
Right.
That's great. And then Commissioner Burkholder, do you have something you wanted to ask?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I simply wanted to remind the Commission that the choices for who is working on public policy for the sake of Utah women are not confined to the brand new Women's Leadership Institute or the Women in the Economy Commission. That organizations like the YWCA are working very hard to strengthen public policy on behalf of all women throughout the state. So it's not down just to these two groups. There are others, and in order to make good policy, we'll want to include everyone who wants to make good change on behalf of Utah women.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I know it's timing, but, you know, I think that's a great comment, and I appreciate that reminder, because
really not everyone is going to align on everything that we say, and not every group is going to support it. And that's probably one of the biggest faults in, you know, with regards to majority versus a minority, that everybody believes that if you're in the minority, everybody should be in the same place. And if it's a majority, it's okay for them to have dissonance. I mean, the entire state, you know, government is a majority having dissonance, right? I mean, and that's okay. I mean, nobody criticizes that all men dramatically and everything. So when all women can't agree on something, they're like, oh, how dare they don't agree on something. I mean, that's part of empowering us as women, that we don't necessarily have to agree on everything that we say or everything that we do. So to that point, and I think that's why I was mentioning a group that is, you know, that's very exciting to see them happening, and this is coming from someone that works at Vinefax, a huge corporation, to see them pushing for women in those positions of power and leadership. I'm, you know, woo, success. Hopefully I'll make it through the press now. I'm sure. I appreciate that. But the point is, you know, to me right now, if you think from this perspective, I'm right now dealing with whether kids can even access the STEM program or not. And maybe the YMCA, someone I've worked with, my female coordinator for years, you know, maybe you guys are empowering, I know it's a lot is empowering women in so many levels, but maybe your priority right now is saying, how do we keep them safe? I mean, there are just different niches, and it doesn't mean that they can coincide with sometimes or not, you know. Sometimes they're just all going to be in different places. So I appreciate that. It's being a reminder that there is a lot of groups working, there's a lot of, you know, ideas happening, and no, they're not exclusive. At the same time, to me, because we have this opportunity that never happened before in Utah, having a community government, you know, like the state legislature and the governor acknowledging that there's a need and a gap and maybe we need to address this, is this is time to push policy that makes sense. I mean, for a change. Because the reality is the crazy policies are happening. I mean, we see them every session. So there, please be in mind that those people are still pushing policies that are not necessarily helpful to close the gap.
Representative Edwards has a comment. Just building on some of the recent comments here, I just wanted to let the commission know that I had a conversation with the Senate sponsor, Senator Bramble, of the original bill this week, where he recommitted his support of the Women in the Economy Commission and his desire that the sunset be repealed in its entirety, that this be an ongoing commission that exists in perpetuity, because he feels like this is really something that is a journey, not a destination, and that ought to be our focus. And it is his intention to, on the Senate side, push as best he can with all of his confidence. He was confident that he would be able to do this on the Senate side, to remove the sunset entirely and maintain the reporting component, because that's an important part of getting that information out there, as has just been said. But that the push for equal opportunity and level playing fields and giving women a fair shot is worthy of our best effort, and I think that ought to give us a lot of confidence and could be part of our, you know, mission statement or whatever kind of reminder going forward. So just wanted to give everyone that little heads up on where Senator Bramble is.
All right, everyone. We'll go ahead and adjourn. Thank you so much for your time today and for all the good work you continue to do on behalf of the Commission and our community.